the passage I wanted to read for today. There's a new translation of that by my friend Venerable Brahmali, and I was hoping to be able to read from that translation, but that's not published yet, and the version of it that's I can get access to is obviously not loading. So let me just see whether I can do this instead. Okay, so as we continue with our discussion of the life of the Buddha, we have traced the Buddha's birth and his early life, and we have looked at a number of the events that have happened after he's gone forth and leading up to the point of his enlightenment. I haven't talked about all of those things, and there are a number of interesting discussions of his practices in that period, not only the two most famous episodes of the practice with the Upanishadic teachers, which we looked at yesterday, the practice of self-mortification with the Jains, which we haven't looked at in detail, even though that's actually a very entertaining passage, but I'm going to leave that one. Then at the end of the passage with the practice with the Jains, then, as we heard a couple of days ago, the Buddha then reflected, why am I afraid of this pain? Why am I afraid of this pleasure? Remembering the pleasure of jhana he experienced as a child. And then he reflected, I'm not afraid of that pleasure because it has nothing to do with unwholesome things. So then he asked himself, could that be the path to enlightenment? And then the insight came that indeed is the path to enlightenment. And that was a really fundamental shift in the Buddha's practice, to realize that following that natural way of experiencing pleasure will lead to awakening. There's then a few more discourses that talk about that period, particularly things like the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta, or the Upakilesa Sutta, which discuss the Buddha's meditation practices in that period. Should I read those? Maybe I should read one of them. Why don't I do that? I'm going to read the Upakilesa Sutta. I was going to go straight to the enlightenment. But actually, the Upakilesa Sutta is a really nice one, so I might read that for this evening. And just have to find it. Here we go. Okay. So this is a somewhat longer sutta passage than the ones we've been reading so far. It's a bit more narrative to it. So I'll just get right down to the reading the sutta. So I have heard, at one time the Buddha was staying near Kosambi in Gohosita's monastery. Now at that time the mendicants of Kosambi were arguing, quarrelling and fighting, continually wounding each other with barbed words. Then a mendicant went up to the Buddha, bowed, stood to one side and told him what was happening, adding, "Please, sir, go to these mendicants out of compassion." The Buddha consented in silence. Then the Buddha went up to those mendicants and said, "Enough, mendicants, stop arguing, quarrelling and fighting." When he said this, one of the mendicants said to the Buddha, "Wait, sir, let the Buddha, the Lord of the Dhamma, remain passive, dwelling in blissful meditation in the present life. We will be known for this arguing, quarrelling and fighting." And a second time and a third time the Buddha asked the mendicants to stop, and a third time the mendicants requested that the Buddha just remain passive. So this is a story known as the quarrel at Kosambi, and is one of the most well-known disputes in the early period of the Buddha Sangha. It began with a discussion of And does anybody know what the origin of the argument was? Sorry? How to use a toilet. Thank you. So one of the monks left water in the water dipper in the toilet, and another monk came in and said, you shouldn't leave the water in the water dipper. And the reason why is because in India and in tropical countries generally, if you leave the water out, then the mosquitoes will come and plant their larvae in there. And so they'll have living beings in it within two or three days. So usually you make sure that all the water is covered so that you don't have living beings in there, which then might be killed. So anyway, one of the monks says, this is against the Vinaya, you've broken the Vinaya rule. And then the other monk said, no, it's not. And he said, yes, it is. And he said, no, it's not. And then everybody got on one side and the other and they started arguing. And that's what that quarrel was about. And if you know anything about monastic communities, you know that that's an incredibly realistic scenario. Because that is indeed exactly the kind of thing that we like to argue about. Anyway, so as you can see, things got way out of hand. I mean, look, I can understand that people would, you know, you can have tensions and things like that in monastic communities and things aren't always perfect. And I understand that. But I do think it's very, very weird, like why would you do it even when the Buddha is asking you not to, right? I mean, okay, fine. Right, so the Buddha tried to help and then he gave up. This is one of the most inspiring things in the Buddha's life. To me, the fact that he gave up. I've tried to follow this example as much as I possibly can. Whenever I get the opportunity, because we can't solve everything and we can't fix every problem and we don't have any moral obligation to fix every problem, and it doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with us because we say this isn't working, I'm just going to walk out of it. Actually, that's a good thing to do, because if you stay there you're wasting your time. And you have no moral obligation to be wasting your time trying to fix something that you can't fix. And it doesn't mean that the Buddha doesn't care. It doesn't mean that he didn't want to help them. It's just that he recognized that there's nothing that he can do. So you walk out the door. And sometimes, that's a great thing to do. The Buddha robed up in the morning. Taking his bowl and robe, he entered Kosambi for alms. After the meal, on his return from alms round, he set his lodgings in order. Taking his bowl and robe, he recited these verses while standing right there. And then there's a very famous series of verses. When many voices shout at once, no one thinks that they're a fool. While the sangha's being split, none thought another to be better. Dolts pretending to be astute, they talk, their words right out of bounds. They blab at will, their mouths agape, and no one knows what leads them on. I mean, it's kind of harsh, right? He abused me, he hit me, he beat me, he took from me. Those who cling to hate like this never settle their enmity. He abused me, he hit me, he beat me, he took from me. Those who never cling to hate always settle their enmity. For enmity in this world is never settled by enmity, it's only settled by love. This is an ancient principle. Others don't understand that our lives must have limits. The clever ones who know, it's actually a mistake, I've updated this translation. Others here don't understand that we must be restrained in this. The clever ones who know this settle their quarrels right away. Breakers of bones and takers of life, thieves of cattle, horses, wealth, those who plunder the nation, even they can come together. Why on earth can't you? If you find an alert companion, a wise and virtuous friend, then overcoming all challenges, wander with them joyful and mindful. If you find no alert companion, no wise and virtuous friend, then like a king who flees his conquered realm, wander alone like a tusker in the wilds. It's better to wander alone, for a fool can never be a friend. Wander alone and do no wrong, at ease like a tusker in the wilds. So these very famous verses, a number of these verses also included elsewhere in the suttas, in the Dhammapada, and the Buddha's, you know, very powerful reflections on the nature of communal life. Right? So the first verse is talking about how when everybody's yelling at the same time. And this is like when many voices shout at once, no one thinks that they're a fool. This is like the kind of the motto of Twitter, right? I mean, this is like... This is the world that we've built. They blab their talks right out of bounds. And this kind of idea of nursing enmity by continuing reflecting on all of the bad things that people have done for you. I mean, this is such an insightful statement on enmity, hatred, or enmity is hatred, but it's more specifically is like nursing a kind of anger at a particular person, like thinking of the person as your enemy. Yeah. So enmity is to think of someone as your enemy. So that mind state that keeps on going over all the things, the bad things that have been done to you, how it wasn't fair, how they did this, how she did that, how he did that, and then all these things go around in your mind and they just create this anger. So enmity in this world is never settled by enmity, it's only settled by love. This is an ancient principle. And then that verse, which is really, again, I mean, some of these verses are pretty strong, right? Breakers of bones and takers of life, thieves of cattle, horses, wealth, those who plunder the nation, even they can come together. Why on earth can't you? Yeah. So, and then the final verse is the idea that... it's good to have a good friend and a spiritual companion, somebody who's going to be with you and to help you and support you and practice together with you. Then that's one of the greatest blessings that we can have in our spiritual life. But life isn't always that good, and we can't always have that. Sometimes we have to be alone. If we have a partner who we can practice with, it's so lucky and we're so blessed. But it's fine also to be alone and to just wander by ourselves. And so this is what the Buddha then continued to do. The Buddha then went to the village of the child salt miners, where Venerable Bhagu was staying at the time. Bhagu saw the Buddha coming off in the distance, so he spread out a seat and placed water for washing the feet. The Buddha sat on the seat spread out and washed his feet. Bhagu bowed to the Buddha and sat down to one side. The Buddha said to him, I hope you're keeping well, mendicant. I hope you're all right, and I hope that you're having no trouble getting alms food. I am keeping well, sir. I am all right, and I'm having no trouble getting alms food. And the Buddha encouraged, educated, fired up, and inspired Bhagu with a Dhamma talk, after which he got up from his seat and set out for the Eastern Bamboo Park. Now, at that time, the Venerables Anuruddha, Nandiya and Kimbira were staying in the Eastern Bamboo Park. The gatekeeper saw the Buddha coming off in the distance and said to him, Don't come into this park, ascetic. There are three gentlemen who love themselves staying here. Don't disturb them. So you can imagine that, the monastery attendant telling the Buddha that he can't come in. So this is, of course, one of the many passages that shows that the Buddha just looked like an ordinary person. So if you thought that the Buddha walked around 3 feet off the air with glowing hands, then no, that isn't the case. Or perhaps it was. Perhaps that's why he kept him out of the park. I don't know. But no, the Buddha just looked like an ordinary monk wandering around the place. And notice how the description, it's one of those words that it's a little bit difficult to translate, but the description of the monk staying there, three Kulaputta. And Kulaputta is a common term in Pali, which is a little bit difficult to translate, and I've translated it with great reluctance as gentleman. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates Kulaputta as clansman. But if you search for the images of what clansman means, well, it either means nasty people in pointy white hats or Scotsmen with kilts. That's the kind of the collective id of Google Images tells you that's what clansman means. So Kuluputta is it's a rather elusive term, but it's a term that that is used for people who have a sense of, who have some status in society. So kula means a family, putta means the son. So a son of family is the literal meaning, but it really means a son of a good family. So it's used in the sense of a bit like the word we would use in English, that we use the word gentleman. And normally I try to avoid gendered language in my translations, but when I was doing the research, because you can't really, in English, you can say gentle person sort of is not quite the same. But when I researched it, I found that in this kind of sense, actually, it does seem to actually be a gendered term. So kuladita is not really found in the same sense. So I felt it was acceptable to use the term gentleman for it. And then they're described as gentlemen who love themselves, which is interesting, right? And so they are gentlemen who love themselves. So that's why they're practicing meditation. So Anuruddha, one of the great disciples, heard the park keeper conversing with the Buddha and said to him, "Don't keep the Buddha out, good park keeper. It's our teacher, the Blessed One, who's arrived." Then Anuruddha went to Nandiya and Kimbila and said to them, "Come forth, venerables, come forth. Our teacher, the Blessed One, has arrived." Then Anuruddha, Nandiya, and Kimbila came out to greet the Buddha. One received his bowl and robe, one spread out a seat, and one set out water for washing the feet. The Buddha sat down on the seat spread out and washed his feet. The venerables bowed and sat down to one side. So these duties which the monks are performing for the Buddha are not necessarily special duties to do for the Buddha himself. In fact, there's a long section about monastic etiquette and how to receive people. And one of the things to bear in mind is that in those days, when a wandering monk or nun would arrive in a monastery, that they were coming from a long journey very often. I mean, they've been walking for days. And this is sort of a truncated account, but it's quite a long way that the Buddha's just walked. And so walking on these dusty roads for many days. And so it's considered to be an important part of that etiquette to have the kindness to the want to the travelers and to extend that warmth of the reception of somebody who is your guest in your house. So they would take his bowl and robe, spread out a seat for him, and put out water for washing his feet. Remember, of course, that his feet would be dirty after walking barefoot for a long time. What's also interesting in Theravadan Buddhist countries these days, it's quite a common custom to wash the monk's feet. And this would certainly happen when I was in Thailand, when you'd get back from alms round. So the junior monks would wash the feet of the senior monks. In Sri Lanka, it's also quite a common custom, and Burma as well. You know, even if you're visiting someone's house, they will often more or less symbolically wash your feet for you. And it's quite a beautiful custom. But one of the things that it's interesting to notice is that you don't find that in the suttas. In the sutta, the Buddha washes his own feet. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So the Buddha said to Anuruddha, "I hope you're keeping well, Anuruddha and friends. I hope you're all right, and I hope you're having no trouble getting alms food." So again, just to, shouldn't spend too much time talking about translation issues, but anyway, I'm probably going to do that, so bad luck. So this term of address that the Buddha is using, he addressed it normally. In Pali, you have a form of addressing someone, so you might address them with their name or their title or something like that. So the Buddha's addressing Anuruddha with his name, but there's three monks living there. And this particular idiom in Pali is a bit hard to convey because he addresses Anuruddha, but in a plural form. So it's Anuruddhas. Yeah, is who he's addressing. But actually, it's a term of address. It's an idiom for how they would address that group of people, because Anuruddha was the senior member of that group of people. So they're all addressed under Anuruddha's name. And so I tried to sort of kludge my way around that idiom by saying Anuruddha and friends. Then the Buddha says, "I hope you're living in harmony, appreciating each other without quarreling, blending like milk and water, and regarding each other with kindly eyes. Indeed, sir, we live in harmony, as you say. But how do you live this way?" In this case, sir, I think, I'm fortunate, so very fortunate, to live together with spiritual companions such as these. I consistently treat these venerables with kindness by way of body, speech and mind, both in public and in private. I think, why don't I set aside my own ideas and just go along with these venerables' ideas? And that's what I do. Though we're different in body, sir, we're one in mind, it seems to me. And the Venerables Nandiya and Kimbila spoke likewise, and they added, that's how we live in harmony, appreciating each other without quarrelling, blending like milk and water, and regarding each other with kindly eyes. Good, good, Anuruddha and friends, but I hope you're living diligently, keen and resolute. Indeed, sir, we live diligently, but how do you live this way? In this case, sir, whoever returns first from the alms round prepares the seats and puts out drinking water and the rubbish bin. If there's anything left over, whoever returns last eats it if they like. Otherwise, they throw it out where there is little that grows, or drop it into water that has no living creatures. Then they put away the seats, drinking water and rubbish bin, and sweep the refectory. If someone sees that the pot of water for washing, drinking or the toilet is empty, they set it up. If he can't do it, he summons another with a wave of the hand, and they set it up by lifting it with their hands. But we don't break into speech for that reason. And every 5 days we sit together for the whole night and discuss the teachings. That's how we live diligently, keen and resolute. So you might recall I actually referred to this in the discussion about keeping silence. And so this is one of the examples of the monks who would live together, and they wouldn't be chit-chatting about things and even doing their work and so on. They wouldn't speak unless necessary, but they would discuss Dhamma every 5 nights. And the Buddha said, good, good, Anuruddha and friends. But as you live diligently like this, have you achieved any superhuman distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, a meditation at ease? Well, sir, while meditating diligent, keen and resolute, we perceive both light and vision of forms. But before long, the light and the vision of forms vanish. We haven't worked out the reason for that. Well, you should work out the reason for that. Before my awakening, when I was still an unawakened but intent on awakening, I too perceived both light and vision of forms. But before long, my light and vision of forms vanished. It occurred to me, what is the cause? What's the reason why my light and vision of forms vanish? It occurred to me, doubt arose in me, and because of that, my immersion fell away. When immersion falls away, the light and vision of forms vanish. I'll make sure that doubt will not arise in me again. So the Buddha goes on to give a series of teachings like this, but I'll just have a look at this one before we go on. So there's again a number of very interesting things about this discussion. First thing is, notice how the Buddha approaches the Sangha there and talking about this discussion, right? Begin with talking about simple things, that you're well, you're getting enough to eat, and then little bit by little bit, talk about monastery duties, how you're living together in harmony, and so on. And then when all of that stuff's sorted out, then we get to talk about the really good stuff, right? And this very, very characteristic of the Buddha's approach, always taking a gradual approach to things, always taking a grounded approach to practice. And so this is not just a historical happenstance that this is how the Buddha made that inquiry, but it's also about how you should be practicing, about what's important in practice, right? And the implication being, of course, that if you're not getting those simple things right, living in harmony, doing your duties in harmony, living a content life, then how are you going to get those advanced things in practice done? And, you know, I honestly can't tell you how many times I've seen in spiritual communities people just completely ignoring these basic, simple principles of Dhamma. And people will have a conflict in their group, in their Buddhist society or something, and then they'll go away and say, just try to meditate and do metta for the other person and solve this problem. That's not how you do it. This is a problem with your sila. It's a problem at the level of ethics and level of speech, and you need to address it at that level. What did the Buddha do with the monks quarreling in Kosambi? Did he say, oh, I'm just going to sit here and do metta for everyone? That's what they wanted him to do. Right? The ones who were quarreling, that's what they said. Oh, you just sit here and just meditate and let us get on with our quarreling. Yeah. So you can't just take a purely passive approach to these kinds of things. These are community issues, and they need to be addressed at a community level. And only when that community is at peace do we have an opportunity to do that meditation. This is a really important basic principle of Dhamma. So these guys are meditating, and these, you know, you have to remember Anuruddha was like, he was one of the mega stars of the Sangha. I mean, he was like super cool, right? There's a whole Sanyutta Nikaya about his awesome meditation and all of the super cool stuff that he could do, right? And yet here he's talking about all the struggles that he had in meditation. Now, you might be thinking, if only I had those struggles, right? I have all these bright lights and fantastic stuff appearing in meditation. It doesn't last for all that long, okay? So you might be thinking, I wish I had that problem. But the fact remains is it wasn't just that he sat down to meditate and everything just happened. Even somebody like him, who's obviously very talented, very dedicated, who's in those great situations to practice applying himself to meditation, it was a journey and it was a struggle. And when he says to the Buddha that he had this struggle, what does the Buddha say? Does the Buddha say, well, here, this is how you solve it? No, the Buddha doesn't say that. The Buddha's not lecturing at him. He's not telling him what he's doing wrong. The Buddha's empathizing with him and saying, actually, I had that same problem too. Right? The Buddha starts with a point of empathy. And so he's talking about how in the Buddha's practice, he just didn't just get it right away either. And so sometimes when we looked at that period of practice between the Buddha going forth and becoming enlightened, and if you just look at the highlights of that practice, you know, the Buddha leaves, he goes forth, he goes practices with the Alarika Lama and Uddaka Ramaputta, then he leaves them and he goes and does the self-mortification, Jain-style practices, then he finishes that, then he reflects, I haven't got anywhere by practicing this very painful practice, remembers the occasion when he got jhana as a child. Perhaps that's the way. Yes, I think that's the way. And then he practices jhana and then he gets enlightened. And if you just look at the summary like that, it looks like that last bit happens right away. But there's a number of suttas, especially in the Majjhima Nikaya, that show that between that point of reflecting on practicing jhana and actually getting enlightened, that there was a considerable period of practice. Suttas like the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta, the Mahavihārava Sutta, and this one, the Upakilesa Sutta, are very interesting reminiscences of that period. And the overriding sense that you get from that period of practice was that the Buddha was a struggling meditator. He didn't just kind of sit there and just whoop, pop into it and it's all going to work, right? He was actually putting it together bit by bit. And I think it's really important to remember this. So when he was still intent on awakening, he too perceived light and vision of forms. But before long, my light and vision of forms vanished. It occurred to me, what's the cause, what's the reason why my light and vision of forms vanish? So the phrase here, the light and the vision of forms, of course, is a very interesting phrase. The light is obhasa, the vision of form is rupana dasanang. So this is obviously a reference to what in modern meditation circles we call the nimitta. And this question of the nimitta in meditation has given rise to a too much ill-informed discussion, And the basic root of the confusion about why there's ill-informed discussion is because people don't acknowledge the fact or recognize the fact that the meaning of the words has changed since the time of the Buddha to the time of the commentaries. In the commentaries, especially the Visuddhimagga, the light that's perceived in meditation is called a nimitta. The word nimitta literally means sign. And the word nimitta is never used in the early suttas in that sense. So the word nimitta, when the word nimitta is used in this, in the context of meditation in the early suttas, what it means is something like a characteristic or quality of the mind. For example, in the Satipatthana Sanyutta, the Buddha talks about that one should learn to understand the character of one's own mind, one's own citta nimitta. What does that mean? Well, he gives the example of a chef who works for a king. And when a chef works for a king, then he will prepare a dish, one that's salty, one that's sour, and one that's bland, and offer them to the king, and he'll see which one does the king eat. And if the king eats the sour one, then he takes note of that. And if the next day the king eats the salty one and then eats the bland one, then he'll know, oh, the king likes a variety of foods. But if the king always takes the salty one, then he knows, oh, the king takes salty food, and then he'll make sure that he only gives him salty food in future. And this is understanding that nimitta. This is what it means. Obviously, he's not talking about seeing a light. The word nimitta does not mean light. Right? It's understanding the nature of the king's mind, the king's preferences. So a skilled meditator would understand the nature of their own mind in meditation. What, if they do this, what will happen? If I do metta meditation, how does my mind respond to that? If I practice sitting for a long time, does that help me? If I sit for just a short time, is that useful? If I do a lot of walking meditation, is that helpful? If I meditate at this time of the day, does that help or not help? This is how you understand the character of your own mind, the cittasa nimitta. That's what it means in the suttas. Right? So more generally, the nimitta in the suttas means something like this. It means a quality of the mind which, when you pay attention to it, it promotes the growth of similar and related qualities. So you notice that if I pay attention to my breath, for example, my breath is something which is very peaceful, then that will promote the growth of similar peaceful qualities in my own mind. So this is something like what the word nimitta means in the suttas. And some people have argued on the basis of that means that there's no such thing as that nimitta, as seeing a light in meditation and samadhi in the suttas, and that therefore anyone who's talking about that doesn't know what they're talking about. But of course, the problem is that the language has changed. What the later tradition calls a nimitta, the early tradition simply calls a light. Right? It's not used, there's no metaphor here, it just says light. This is what you're seeing. Obviously it's talking about the same thing. And it's not just here that it talks about this, it's very common right throughout the suttas. So common, in fact, that the very words for meditation contain that metaphor inside them. The word jhana means illumination. Right, so jhana has two roots in Sanskrit. One of them means a mind state that's fixed and focused, just like an absorbed state of mind. And the other state of mind means a fire or a lamp that glows. And Pali contains both of those meanings. So the very word jhana means something that's illumined and glows. And so does the word samadhi, interestingly enough. One of the meanings of the word samadhi is the kindling of a fire. So this idea of the brightness of the mind in a state of samadhi is essential to the teachings of the suttas and is, as you see here, very kind of fundamental. One of the things that's a little bit confusing about this particular passage is that the word nimitta is also, and I'm sorry about this technical discussion, but I'm giving this technical discussion is because if I don't discuss it now, someone's going to ask me about it, and then I'm going to talk about it later anyway. So I might as well just get it done now. All right. So in this particular passage, the word nimitta is in fact used. But it's used in that sense that I mentioned before, and I've translated it in this context as reason. So we haven't worked out the reason for that. right? The nimitta for that. So you're looking, what is the quality of mind? What is the thing that's going on in your mind that causes this other thing to happen? This is what's meant by the nimitta in that sense. So it's one of the meanings of nimitta is cause or reason. So, so the word nimitta is used, but not in the sense of the light. In the sense of the light is used. But one of the things that is interesting about this passage and is a genuine interpretive question, and I'm not sure of the answer, just so you know, I don't know all of the answers. I just pretend that the thing like the light, right, which is clearly is the radiance you see in meditation, but also the vision of forms. And that's kind of curious because the forms here is in plural. Rupani pasati. So what is actually that referring to? And that's never really defined, but it may be, could be a number of things, but certainly the vision of something. It could be in certain kinds of meditation you envisage colors, right? So it could be something like that. That's the kind of rupa that you would see. Possibly it refers to something like the visions of what you might see in past lives, but I don't think that that would really apply in this particular context. I'm honestly not 100% sure what it means when it uses the plural form of rupas in this particular context. So, and then the first case, so the Buddha's reflecting on why did the light and vision of forms vanish, and it occurred to me because doubt arose in me, and because of that my immersion fell away. So doubt, of course, being one of the hindrances, as we've discussed, so the hindrance arose and then the samadhi fell away. Now, so many interesting things about this, but one of the interesting things is that when Aniruddha said to the Buddha that we're having this problem in meditation, the Buddha didn't say to him, this is the answer to your problem. He said, well, this is what happened to me, and in that case, this was the answer to the problem. Right? He's teaching them a method of inquiry so that they can find out the answers to their problems. Because, of course, there can be a lot of reasons why your meditation falls apart, right? So the Buddha doesn't want to just tell them this is what's happening. He wants to teach them how to find out for themselves. Right? So inquire into the reasons. This is why I'm always saying in the end of every meditation, reflect back, look at why things are happening in your meditation. So then the Buddha goes on to discuss a number of other cases where these different kinds of defilements or issues arose in meditation. In the next case, it's because he lost focus. That's why the light and the vision of forms vanished. So then I will practice to that neither doubt nor loss of focus occur again. Next time it was dullness and drowsiness, and then terror. And terror is an interesting one, right? The Buddha doesn't just say like fear or nervousness or something like that. And in case you're not sure whether terror is a correct translation, he gives a simile. Suppose a person was traveling along a road and killers were to spring out at them from both sides. They'd be terrified because of that. Right? So clearly the Buddha's not talking about just feeling a bit nervous or a bit anxious in meditation. He's talking about being terrified. Right? Interesting, right? And that's actually a genuine experience. Why do you feel terrified in meditation? I mean, it could be for a number of reasons, right? I mean, who knows what those forms are? Right? I mean, it could be a yakka, a ghost, right? I don't know. But more likely, I think, what it means when the Buddha says that he's experiencing that terror, what happens, and this is quite a common thing that happens in meditation, is you come face to face with the unknown. And you let go. And when you let go, it's hella scary. And you don't know what's on the other side of that. And there's that point where you have to go forward into the light. And then sometimes it's just, your heart starts beating, you start sweating, you get nervous, you're shaking. It's so terrifying because you're leaving behind this whole world. Everything you've ever known, you're leaving behind. The next one, excitement arose in me, right? So excitement Buddha again gives a simile in this case. Suppose a person was looking for an entrance to a hidden treasure. And all at once, they'd come across five entrances. They'd be excited because of that. Okay, sure enough. So again, this is something that here, remember that in this whole passage, the Buddha's talking about the kinds of things that tend to happen when you're in deep meditation and your mind is starting to get very peaceful, light is starting to appear in your mind, you're getting close to samadhi, but it's still a bit rocky and a bit shaky. So one of the things that happens at that point is, yes, this is it, I'm nearly there, this must be jhana now, right? I'm going to get enlightened. And the mind gets really excited, and then it's all gone. Next one, excessive energy arose in me, right? This again is another one of these things that I've talked about in the meditation so far. Suppose a person was to grip a quail too tightly in his hands, and it would die right there. Yeah? Excessive energy. Sorry? A quail, a cute little birdie. It's just a simile, okay? No birds were harmed, right? But, yes, a little bird. So that thing of pushing too much into the meditation, yeah? Applying excessive energy, yeah? Overly lax energy arose in me. Suppose you were to grip a quail too loosely and it flew out of your hands. Yeah? So again, that thing where you're just not applying yourself quite enough. Then while meditating, longing arose in me. Huh? The next one is perceptions of diversity arose in me. Interesting one, right? So perceptions of diversity. So when perceptions of diversity, I mean, it's a very general term, but it what it refers to is when you, like in samadhi, in true samadhi, it's one. There's only one thing. And if there's more than one thing, then it ain't samadhi. So if you're hearing and thinking and smelling and remembering, this is not samadhi. So if you have these diverse perceptions of many different things happening, then this is a sign that your samadhi is falling away. So meditating diligent, keen and resolute, I perceived both light and vision of forms, but before long, my light and vision of forms vanished. What's the cause? Why did they vanish? Then the next one also is a little bit mysterious. Excessive concentration on forms arose in me. Excessive concentration on forms arose in me. I'm not 100% sure exactly what that means, but if whatever these forms are, whatever these rupas that one's seeing in meditation, it looks like that perhaps you're focusing too much on that rather than on the root meditation. So when the Buddha understood that all of these things... Oh, I think I might have missed one. Did I miss discomfort, perceptions of diversity, longing? Excitement. I missed one, sorry. After excitement, there's also discomfort. So discomfort arose in his body. Okay. So when he realized that these things were present and that they were corruptions of the mind, I gave them up. When meditating diligent, keen, and resolute, I perceived light, but did not see forms. Or I saw forms, but I did not see light, and this went on for a whole night, a whole day, or even a whole night and day. I thought, what's the reason for this? He thought, when I don't focus on the foundation of the forms, but focus on the foundation of the light, then I perceive light and do not see forms. But when I don't focus on the foundation of the light, but focus on the foundation of the forms, then I see forms and don't perceive light. And this goes on for a whole night, a whole day, even a whole night and day. And similarly, he saw limited or limitless light and forms, and the same pattern is repeated. So when I understood that doubt, loss of focus, dullness and drowsiness, terror, excitement, discomfort, excessive energy, overly lax energies, longing, perception of diversity and excessive concentration on forms are corruptions of the mind, I gave them up. I thought, I've given up my mental corruptions. Now let me develop immersion in three ways. I developed immersion while placing the mind and keeping it connected, while without placing the mind, but just keeping it connected, without placing the mind or keeping it connected, with rapture, without rapture, with pleasure, and with equanimity. When I developed immersion in these ways, the knowledge and vision arose in me. My freedom is unshakable. This is my last rebirth. Now there are no more future lives. That is what the Buddha said. Satisfied, Venerable Anuruddha was happy with what the Buddha said. So, one of the really lovely suttas and, one of the great example of the teachings in the Majjhima Nikaya, particularly, with a nice narrative background, some lovely verses, a bit of a story to it, and some really detailed and practical information on meditation, as well as some quite intriguing and slightly mysterious ideas about what happens in advanced stages of meditation. And all of those things are actually very characteristic of the Majjhima Nikaya. Klaus. No. Right. Look, it may well be. Yeah. I mean, it seems like a reasonable meditation. The use of the forms is repeated in some other meditation contexts. So things like, say, the eight vimokas, I believe, if I recall correctly, where it says, what is it? Ajata Arupa sanyi bahidha rupani pasati, internally, not perceiving forms internally, one sees forms externally. Something like that. And so you have different permutations like this. So the idea does appear elsewhere, and that's certainly one reading of it. Yeah. I'm just not sure why it uses the plural there. I mean, if it was talking about a kasina, then it would be just like one thing. You do, but why? You're not doing them all at once. You'd think that you're doing this one at a time. Yeah. What is kasina? Thank you for the question. It's important. You have to ask these things. Otherwise, I just assume everybody knows. So, kasina is a kind of meditation, and it's a kind of meditation which is taught sometimes in the suttas, not all that often, but a number of times in the suttas, and is found throughout the Buddhist traditions. And kasina is a kind of meditation which is based on a perception of something, usually based on a perception of something visual, like a color or a physical element. And or it might be like based on, say, a candle, so you can watch a candle flame and see the light of the candle. Or in the Visuddhimagga, in the meditation manual, it talks about like making a disc. So often what people think of when they think of kasina meditation is the like a physical disc. I'm just trying to think if there's something that could be an example of it. So you might make you could even use something like a white dinner plate, as long as it's very pure white, about that size, about the size of a dinner plate, and or like a pure blue color, a pure beautiful color. And then you would focus on that, and then you'd use that as the basis for your meditation. And so you watch that disc until you can feel that the mind has a very clear image of that disc. And then you can close your eyes and then keep the image of it just as clearly with your eyes closed as with your eyes open. And once you can do that, then you can continue with the meditation purely just in your mind. Yeah, that's the idea. Actually, kasina is another one of those cases where the meaning of the word in the suttas is quite different from the meaning of the word in the later tradition. In the later tradition, the meaning of the word is a physical, kasina means a physical object on which your meditation is based. In the suttas, the word kasina is used for the state of meditation which results. So the word kasina, actually, literal meaning of the word kasina is universal. And it's actually a name, it's a word describing the samadhi. But anyway, that's the basic idea behind kasina. Yeah. So, like I said, it's not done so commonly, but people do kasina meditation. And it's a nice one to do if you're, like in certain cases, if like you're just sort of sitting by the fireplace. You know, this is what people do, right? You just look into the fireplace and it's so nice and peaceful. Just watch the flames dancing away. This is fire kasina. It's like breath meditation. There's a reason why we do this, because it's naturally calming. Or you go down to a lake and you just sit by the lake and the water. It's just so beautiful to sit by the water. And that's naturally becomes like a kasina that's supporting your mind to become peaceful. Sorry, yes, that's okay. Yeah. Yeah. I know, it was a bit fast. I wanted to get over it because I didn't want too many questions on it, because then it would take too long. So basically, this is just a way of talking about jhana practice that you find in a few places in the suttas. Normally, of course, you have the four jhanas, and in the first jhana you have five factors: vitakka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata. And the two first ones, vitakka, vichara, go together. And then you go from the first jhana to the second jhana, and second jhana they've ceased. But in that particular exposition, that doesn't quite work like that. Vitakka ceases first, and then vichara ceases second, and then it goes on. So this is like a five-fold jhanas, sometimes called, and the Abhidhamma talks about that. I don't want to talk about it in too much detail, because I'll probably talk about it more later in the retreat, what all these things are. Right. Yeah, that's right. He's basically developing jhanas in this way. And interestingly enough, I mean, lots of people like to argue that there's a path of dry insight in the suttas, that you don't really need jhanas. Mm-hmm. But the textual basis for a path of dry insight is extremely weak. And the textual basis for a path of dry samatha is much stronger. And the Buddha there doesn't actually talk about developing vipassana at all. He only talks about developing samatha and then says he got enlightened. So, make of that what you will. Yes. Dry vipassana, yeah. Dry vipassana, yeah. Well, presumably, yeah. Dry vipassana meaning vipassana that's done without jhanas, without samadhi. Yeah. Sorry, yeah, Isabella. I do, because no. I'll talk about that more in some later talks, because it'll get a bit much if I talk about it all today. Is that okay? Right, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just something that happens in the meditation, right? So he's not saying that this is a particular stage of insight or anything like that. It's just saying that this is something that was an obstacle to him in at a certain time in the meditation. Practicing what? The discomfort's got nothing to do with vipassana. Vipassana means insight into impermanent suffering and not self. Yeah, so the fact that you experience some discomfort along the way has got really nothing to do with that. Yeah, I mean, the aspect of vipassana, if you like, that he was developing there was the fact that he was doing an inquiry into causes. Why is this thing happening? Why are the lights vanishing from our meditation? And to understand the reasons why, that's vipassana. Yeah, and that's using the vipassana to support the samatha, using the insight to support the peace of mind. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Sila was lacking is a kind way of putting it. Yes, I appreciate the diplomatic speech there. Angulimala, for those who don't know, was a serial killer. So yes, his ethics was lacking. Yeah. So what's the question? Is it okay? Are you like looking for an example to follow, or it's interesting though, isn't it? Right? Yeah, it's fascinating. And I think that those stories, again, you know, how literally we can take those stories, I can't say. But the point of that story is it's a story of redemption, and it's a story to say that no matter how bad someone is, that there's always a chance. And people do terrible things for misguided and terrible reasons, but there are many examples of people who have been killers and murderers who reform, and a number of cases of prisoners on death row who've become very, very good Buddhists and practitioners and practicing of meditation. And I don't know if any of them became enlightened, but they certainly turned their lives around. So, to me, that's really the point of that story of Angulimala.